Welcome back to The Deep Dive. Today, we're digging into some fascinating sources about Dyson. We're looking at that really interesting mix of invention, smart business thinking, and crucially, intellectual property.
Exactly. And our mission, if you like, is to unpack how Dyson, you know, the name everyone knows for innovation, actually built its success. Because it wasn't just about cool products. It was deeply tied to a really strategic view on IP, especially patents.
Right.
And we're drawing heavily on a great interview with Gil Smith, who's Dyson's group IP director. That's from the 4IP Council.
Okay, so buckle up. We're going behind the scenes, looking at the mindset driving these inventions, the actual cash value of patents, you could say, and what it all suggests about innovation more broadly. Mm-hmm. So to really get Dyson, you have to start with the founder, right? James Dyson. His personality, his whole approach seems baked into the company's DNA.
Oh, absolutely. It's fascinating. His philosophy, apparently, is that failure is where things start. He actually said, you get hundreds and thousands of failures, the failure is the starting point.
Well.
And think about it. Over 5,000 prototypes for his first big invention. He nearly went bankrupt. That kind of experience, well, it embeds a certain resilience, a unique way of approaching innovation. Right across the company.
5,000 failures. I mean, just imagine the persistence required. You'd want to give up, surely.
You'd think so, but he didn't. And what's really key here is that his focus on IP, on patents, wasn't an afterthought. It was there right from the start, back in the early 80s.
Early 80s, before they were even a big name.
Exactly. And that commitment just grew, as the company did. You know, now employing thousands of highly skilled people globally, that respect for IP was foundational.
So, okay, that brings us to the patents themselves. You're saying they weren't just defensive, but sort of an engine for success.
A completely unseen engine, in many ways, protecting the inventions, the things that actually made their products better than the competition that was always critical for them. It's not just having the idea, it's locking it down.
Makes sense. But I have to ask the what-if question. Could they have done it anyway? You know, just built better stuff and marketed it well without all the patent hassle. What did Gil Smith say about that?
Yeah, she acknowledges it's tough to rewind history, you know, play the what-if game, but she's pretty clear that the patents, and maybe more importantly, winning the court cases to enforce those patents, that was absolutely key.
Winning in court, right.
Yeah, that shaped the company.
Right.
And think about the scale of their R&D investment now. It's something like 3 million pounds per week.
3 million pounds.
Every week.
Wow.
It's a huge amount. And patents are basically how they can justify and eventually recuperate that massive spend.
Okay, so how does that work exactly? How do patents help get that money back? Is it purely stopping copycat?
That's a huge part of it, definitely. Gil Smith is very clear. Dyson just doesn't sell unprotected products, period. Because without the IP, they know they'd be copied fast. And she says they'd be in a very different place today. It underlines how IP isn't just legal paperwork. It's the economic foundation that lets them keep investing in making things better. It protects that huge R&D spend.
So that investment pays off through protection. What are the sort of tangible benefits they've seen from all this patenting effort?
Well, Gil Smith points to two main things. First, it really helped them establish a clear market position, especially early on.
How so?
Those initial court cases, back when Dyson was, you know, the little guy taking on established players, they sent a message. They taught competitors that Dyson was not to be messed with.
Oh, okay.
It let them, as she put it, punch far above its weight. The patents gave them leverage and credibility.
Great, establishing their territory. And what was the second benefit?
The second one is maybe more obvious. It lets them command premium prices.
Because competitors can't just copy the tech.
Exactly. The patents stop rivals from using Dyson's specific inventions. So the brand becomes strongly associated with that unique problem-solving technology. You pay more because you're getting something genuinely different, and that difference is legally protected.
That makes sense. Now, you mentioned the Hoover thing earlier. That sounds like a fascinating side story. They weren't bothered by people calling their vacuums Hoovers?
Apparently not by the generic term, no.
Right.
But the actual legal fight they had with the company Hoover back in the 90s, that was different.
Okay.
It was a patent infringement case. And while Dyson didn't, like, orchestrate it for PR, the court battle got tons of media attention.
Ah, free advertising.
Sort of, yeah. It really helped the public grasp that Dyson was this new, innovative force, distinct from the older Hoover brand. Gil Smith reckons that distinction really stuck in people's minds, almost by accident.
That's quite a stroke of luck from a legal fight. Okay, so patents clearly worked for Dyson, but there are definitely people who argue the whole system is broken, that we should, you know, get rid of patents altogether. What's Gil Smith's view on that?
She has a very strong counterargument there. Her view is that getting rid of patents, removing those constraints on copying, would just lead to a complete free-for-all on innovation.
A free-for-all? What does she mean by that?
Well, the only business model left would be rush to market first, sell as much as you possibly can, really flaunt it before the copies inevitably flood in.
Mm.
And based on their experience, that copying can happen incredibly fast. She mentioned Chinese copycats appearing just 5 or 6 months after a product launch. Like, they're just waiting.
Wow, 5 or 6 months. So her argument is that the quality would suffer.
Precisely. Why invest millions in making something durable, well-engineered, truly innovative, if you know it'll be copied cheaply almost immediately? Where's the incentive? Where's the return on that huge R&D investment we talked about?
Yeah, good point.
She basically says there's no viable alternative to the patent system that isn't another patent system. You need something like it to encourage companies to actually invest the time and money to create properly designed, high-quality products.
Okay, so scrapping it is a bad idea, in her view. But that doesn't mean the current system is perfect. Does she have ideas for how it could be improved?
Oh, definitely. And they're quite practical, actually. The first big one she calls harmonization.
Harmonization.
Yeah, imagine having fewer global patent offices, maybe, say, less than 10 worldwide. And they'd all operate under the same system, same rules, same languages.
Oh, wow. So like one application could cover you globally.
Sort of like a global version of the European Patent Office, the EPO, yeah. That's the idea. It would make things much more accessible, much simpler, and hopefully more consistent in finding prior art and things like that. Less complexity, lower costs.
That sounds logical. What else?
Another key thing is the need for valid patents. Basically, making sure the patents granted are genuinely strong and defensible, and making it harder to challenge them successfully later on, unless there's a very good reason.
Why is that important?
Well, she mentions this concern, maybe slightly tongue-in-cheek, about some IP attorneys bragging they can get any patent invalidated. The goal should be to grant fewer weak or invalid patents in the first place, so the system has more integrity.
Right, so the patents that are granted actually mean something.
Exactly. And linked to that, she talked about increasing the presumption of validity.
Okay, what does that mean in practice?
It essentially means that once a patent office grants a patent, it should be given more weight, considered more robust. It shouldn't be quite so easy to challenge and overturn it in court later, make the initial examination tougher perhaps, but then give the granted patent more strength.
Okay. Any other tweaks?
Yeah, a couple more. Lowering fees, especially for SMEs, small and medium-sized businesses, to make the system more accessible for them.
That seems fair.
And also, setting a higher bar for inventiveness, really making sure that patents are granted for what she calls proper inventions, not just tiny, trivial tweaks, discouraging those trivial patents. She feels this probably needs regulation because companies will just keep filing borderline stuff if their competitors do.
So focus the system on genuine breakthroughs. Makes sense. Okay, that's fascinating for how the system could change, but let's bring it back to the individual. What about advice for, you know, budding inventors listening right now?
Gil Smith had some very down-to-earth advice. Two main things, really. First, find a patent attorney you actually like, someone you can get on with.
Huh. Why is that so important?
Because she says the whole process can be, well, painful and definitely expensive. So having someone guiding you who you trust and have a good rapport with can make a huge difference.
Good practical advice. What's the second thing?
Don't be greedy, especially with your first invention's royalty rates.
Really? Don't try and strike it rich immediately.
That's the advice. The main aim for your first one, she suggests, should be just covering your costs and maybe making a bit of profit, she mentioned, maybe 10,000 or 20,000 pounds, enough to fund your next idea. It's about building momentum, proving the concept, not necessarily retiring on day one.
Right, play the long game. Okay, so wrapping this up then, Dyson's story, it really feels like a powerful case study. It's about that founder's resilience, sure, but also about really understanding the strategic power of IP.
Absolutely. It shows patents aren't just legal bits of paper. They're active tools, tools for shaping a market, for protecting those huge R&D bets, and, you know, ultimately for encouraging real, sometimes difficult innovation.
So the final thought, perhaps, for you listening.
Yeah, maybe think about this. If the whole point of the patent system, flaws and all, is to encourage companies to invest in creating the best possible products, the most advanced technologies, what's our role in that?
Hmm. As consumers, as innovators ourselves.
Right. What responsibility do we have to understand this system, maybe even advocate for making it better so it genuinely rewards that kind of deep inventiveness? Just consider, you know, how much you value the quality and the engineering and the things you use every day. Is that value maybe connected, even indirectly, to the IP protection that allows companies to invest so much in the first place? Something to think about.